It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're doing a different kind of show today, not just about paddling or skiing. We're doing a show about learning. We all learn outdoors, learning how to hunt or survive, or learning about the environment. We scientists learn from the outdoors to publish scientific papers and increase the formal body of knowledge. But in recent decades, more people have realized these kinds of learning can overlap, and they can interact in productive ways. Scientists are seeking traditional knowledge from Alaska natives, and elders are seeing radical changes out there in the environment, and they're looking at ways to share those insights. On today's show, we're looking at this exchange of knowledge from both directions. It's a pretty unique program, and I hope you'll stick with it. In the first half, a trekking family did an epic journey to learn from Alaska Native communities about geology. And then in the second half, I'll be talking with an elder from St. Lawrence Island. He's seeing his way of life change pretty dramatically because of the disappearing sea ice, and he wants to tell scientists about it. So stick with us for today's show on Outdoor Explorer, talking about different ways of knowing. In the studio with me right now are Caleb Billmeyer and Kate Homan Billmeyer, who have made a real project of combining their outdoor adventures with getting to know the people of Alaska and studying Alaskan issues and interacting with Native people. One trip in particular that they did to almost circumnavigate Lake Iliamna a couple of years ago, where it sounds like a pretty rigorous trip, actually. I'm reading your article, Caleb, on the that we have linked up on our website at alaskapublic.org. It's under today's show, Cultural Journeys. And you can find this article Caleb wrote, and there's some good photos there of kind of trekking around that huge lake in the wintertime. And just to start with, that sort of give us a sense of what the outdoor challenge was, what you were doing, sort of like how much ground you're covering, what you're trying to accomplish in terms of the outdoor part of it.
Yeah, well, I'd say the biggest challenge, you know, was the winter we had, which was really variable. We had long stretches of warm weather with, you know, some heavy snow followed by really warm and wet weather. And so when you're talking about...
And you were kind of planning to walk on the lake ice for the
most
part,
so
right?
When you're talking about traveling on ice, you know, I didn't know what to expect. There were some webcams we could look at. We could call ahead to the villages and say, what's the ice looking like? You know, how thick is it? Is it normal for this time of year? And we get an impression of that, but we really only got an idea once we showed up. And
had you heard of anybody else doing that particular trip? I never have.
No, not in particular. I know people have traveled around the lake for sure. I mean, for a long time, people have been moving around that lake, but you know, in this particular fashion, not that I know of. So, you know, that was our biggest challenge from my standpoint, is not knowing what kind of conditions we were looking at. And it turns out in Kakanak, which is traditionally a really windy place to begin with, there was no snow. You know, the wind had come through and polished all the tundra clean. And so we ended up, you know, having everything on our backs for the first few days, which was a lot of weight, and we had all our food with us. And so, you know, the variability was kind of the biggest challenge at the outset.
And you're covering about 150 miles in how long?
Yeah, 150 miles, and I think we were, how long was it altogether, Kate?
Just nearly a month. We broke up our trip. We were traveling by ski and pulling pack rafts as sleds for our gear. So we covered about 150 miles in just under a month. We were also spending 4 or 5 days in each of the villages where we were conducting interviews with local individuals. So our travel days were, we had several days of travel in between each village, and those distances mm-hmm. varied.
And what were you trying to learn? What were you talking to people about?
Well, we started this project looking at talking with people about seismic hazards.
We were working with a couple in Sildovia who had through their they have a nonprofit called Ground Truth Trekking.
Mm-hmm. They're famous. Everybody's heard of them.
Yeah, Hig and Aaron, and Hig is a trained geologist, and he's been doing seismic hazard research on the north side of the lake as part of the Lake Clark Fault. And his hard science background, and we moved to Sildovia a number of years ago, and created this relationship with them, and talked to them about our background and how we could potentially work together and pair that up. So the idea was to superimpose these the knowledge of these elders around the lake with the hard science data they had, and see what we could learn and work towards a more cooperative effort.
Yeah. So you're sort of trekking over the ice, and then coming to villages, and then trying to get people in the village to talk to you about their knowledge about the environment there. And some people who haven't done that might not know how difficult that can be when you come sort of from the outside into a place where everybody knows each other, and it's a fairly tight group, but probably pretty unusual for them to have somebody come walking off the ice and start asking a bunch of questions. You got to spend some time to really get to know people, right?
Absolutely. And it's something we put a lot of thought into. And, we were able to reach out and get approval from the communities we visited before we left. So, each village has a traditional council.
Mm-hmm. So they knew you were coming.
They knew we were coming, yeah. We didn't just show up and start asking. So they knew we were coming, and we also asked for a recommendation of people that they would say, these are the people you should talk to, these are the most knowledgeable people, these are the people we want to represent us. So we had that in hand when we showed up, and we showed up during the in Kakanak on the south side of the lake during their winter carnival. And we're able to just relax and meet people and go play bingo and watch fireworks and eat some great food and not really do much in the research sense for a while and kind of talk to people. And it's a big lake, but it's also a small community. So,
word traveled ahead.
Yeah, people knew we were coming, and, kind of the questions we were asking in different villages, even though they're separated by, 50, 60 miles, it's a small community, just like Alaska is as a whole.
Yeah. So a lot of this work you were doing was related in some way to the Pebble Prospect and the idea of a building a mine down there in terms of geology. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I think what spurred the seismic hazard research is, kind of these perceived deficiencies and maybe the amount of that kind of research in the environmental baseline documents.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really talk about Pebble specifically unless it was brought up. Our goal was to talk with people about their experiences, whether it's stories passed down or their direct experiences with earthquakes, extreme weather events, and also just their observations of changing climate. And those were kind of our three main focus areas. And So I think the research is certainly applicable to Pebble, but our effort wasn't necessarily directly connected to it.
So, Kate, as far as doing this journey, what were the hard parts about it? I mean, walking on this frozen lake in the wind, it doesn't sound like all that much fun, but maybe it was just a barrel of laughs. I mean, what was hard or easy about it?
Well, I think trip planning is always a long and involved process. So we spent a lot of time not only thinking about how to conduct the research, but also how to travel between each village, what our best options for gear were and food, and planning ahead and organizing ourselves in that manner. So sending food in advance of ourselves so that we didn't have to carry 1 month's supply of food on our back, making gear choices, and then, as Caleb mentioned, just the variable conditions. So when we started our journey, the intent was to ski, cross-country ski around the lake. And the first 2 days we spent with, as Caleb mentioned, all our gear on our backs, walking across lake ice because it wasn't suitable for skiing and up and over a big mountain. until we did find some snow. So, you know, the first few days were heavy and long.
Start thinking, what did we get ourselves into?
Exactly. Are we going to be walking all 150 miles with our skis, or should we mail them back home? So those variable weather conditions, and again, when we went between New Halen and Pedro Bay, it was quite windy and also very thin ice with open water, and so that was a bit tricky. But also,
did you use the pack rafts to paddle across open water at all?
A couple times.
Yeah, a little bit. We didn't know the Kwijak is a formidable river, so we didn't know if that was going to be a crossing. We ended up being able to go out onto thick lake ice, mm-hmm. well out in the lake, and get around it that way. It stays open, I think, fairly commonly during the winter, just because there's so much moving water there, mm-hmm. at the mouth of the river.
Sure.
There were some small creeks on the south side of the lake. We had to, you know, like ferry over the bags, and then Kate would get in, and we'd have two people in the boat and ferry it over. And,
I was interested in the use of pack rafts as sleds, because it seems like, I mean, as long as you're on smooth snow and ice, fine. But as soon as you get into anywhere that there might be, wood or rock or something, you might have a problem. Did it work out pretty well to use the pack rafts as sleds?
It worked great, and I think where they shine is in that open country.
Yeah.
And you can put, 30-35 pounds in, and it's works pretty well, and they're, very lightweight as far as the sled goes. On the lake, it was ideal. The times we went in the tundra, there's not a whole lot of trees around the lake there, so it's still pretty open. And if you have a little bit of snow cover, they actually do really well in that sense. And it's also nice to have a boat when you're on lake ice. If you end up in the water, you got a boat inflated already. So.
They also doubled as sleeping pads. We were able to use them at night in our tent and get our bodies off the ground a bit. So they served many multiple purposes, and we were quite happy to have used those.
Well. Mm-hmm. So I saw you also chose not to bring a stove or fuel, just to rely on finding wood. And in the wintertime in Alaska, that could work out all right, or it might be iffy. Yeah, that worked. How was that?
It worked great, and it wasn't the kind of thing that we just said, oh, I'm sure it'll be fine. Hig spent a bunch of time around the lake, and I was able to chat with him, and he was... we looked at, some aerial imagery before we went, the areas that, you can find wood here, this might be a little less. But we never had a problem. We planned our days certainly around wind cover and fuel for our cooking at night. So that was kind of the goal the other day. You see that lone patch of spruce on the horizon. You're like, all right, that's where we're sleeping tonight. We'll make it there.
Sounds like you guys... it knew what you're doing, planned pretty well, and therefore you didn't have any untoward adventures. You only had the adventures you were looking for. True?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say
that's how you wanted to go.
Yeah.
Right?
Every trip's got its little, little obstacles. That's part of the fun. We certainly didn't have any catastrophes or anything that was regrettable. Your gear fails a little bit, no matter of a trip of that length. So you bring things to patch and repair and keep going, and that's part of the fun of it, I think.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'm talking with Caleb Billmeyer and Kate Homan Billmeyer. They did a trip 2 years ago in 2013 during the wintertime, most of the way around Lake Iliamna, 150 miles, stopping and talking to folks in the villages and really having a cultural experience as they gathered traditional knowledge from the folks who live there about their environment. And our topic today is about this cultural connection between the stuff we do outdoors and people we can meet and what we can learn from them, what cultures can learn from each other. So perfect guest to have with us, and I really appreciate your being here. Let's talk about this idea of traditional knowledge. I think it's a lot less so now, but in years past, people would say, well, why would you want to talk to people about their anecdotal evidence, and what people knew who live on the land might be discounted. But more and more, I guess, we're finding out that knowledge can be pretty sophisticated. So tell us why traditional knowledge was important to you and what you wanted to in what you wanted to research?
Well, I'd say traditional knowledge is important because, well, you know, first of all, I think traditional knowledge is it defies definition because it's non-tangible. It's, you know, in Western science, I think there's a lot of emphasis put on things you can quantify. This knowledge is, you know, it's cumulative. It's passed down from generation to generation, and it's always changing. It's a dynamic thing. And, you know, before, you know, pre-contact days or before Western scientists came in, it wasn't called traditional knowledge. It's just what people knew how to do and how they lived their lives. And, you know, from our standpoint, it's, you know, the ideal is to have Western science and traditional knowledge being complementary and not necessarily competing. And, you know, as social science researchers, we place value in it in part because it is science. You know, it's empirical observation, you know, stretching back for a long period of time. And, you know, like you said, it's been somewhat recently that it's been accepted as part of the, you know, Western science framework. And, you know, for a long time, it was kind of taboo to put it in these studies because people thought it was anecdotal or, you know, just inherently non-scientific. But I think the tide's changing on that to a certain degree, and rightly so. I think it's gaining more favor in the, you know, Environmental Protection Act research that goes on with any major project in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty is how do you kind of find this, the right combination of combining these two, you know, knowledge systems that aren't necessarily, you know, they don't neatly fit together. You know, mm-hmm. I think Western science is somewhat reductionist. You know, they want to compartmentalize things. You look at any Environmental Protection Act document and, you know, you have your, you know, the different environments split up into chapters. And, you know, I think traditional knowledge is inherently just more holistic. And so it's very difficult on the outset to combine those two things.
Yeah. So what kind of, who were you talking to? And I would like to hear from Kate as well, like what the experience was of going into these villages and striking up these conversations. I've found that in working with in village people, that part of the relationship with the environment is a personal relationship, and so it's not always appropriate just to walk up to somebody and ask them a lot of questions, right? You got to work your way into it. They got to figure out why you want the information, what you're going to do with it. Are you going to bring anything back? Are you going to be contributing to their community? Tell me about your experience of coming into these villages and how you were received.
I think we mentioned earlier that we, at the outset of this project, we wrote letters and wrote about our intentions with the research, what we were hoping to do, and what we were hoping to give back to the communities. And so that happened in advance of our arrival, and some communities chose to participate and others didn't. So they knew we were coming. Once we arrived in the villages, we said we went to Winter Carnival, which was a wonderful experience in Kakanuk. People from around the region came. They were expecting us when we got to their part of the lake. And so we really sort of set up in the tribal councils and met with individuals who were nominated by their peers or by the tribal council as knowledgeable folks that we should speak with. And so that's how our process went. It snowballed in terms of recommendations of individuals that we should talk with. We talk a lot between ourselves about that relationship building and what the research process currently looks like and what we hope it might look like in the future. And I think that was part of the impetus for us traveling overland in this way, because there is such a special and unique relationship between people and land, and that spatial relationship. And so being able to go very slowly around the lake and look at the places that people were talking about and see the things that people were describing, is something that you don't get when you fly in for one meeting and fly out.
Yeah.
So that was a very high priority on our uh-huh. on our research agenda in terms of what we hoped to accomplish, and also producing something for the community, saying, here is your interview transcript, here are photographs that we took along the way, and being able to produce those things for the people who gave us their time and shared their knowledge with us, that was very important yeah. to us.
What did they think of what you're doing? Because most people in rural Alaska use motorized transportation, snow machines, four-wheelers, airplanes. I bet there were not many other people walking around. And did people find that to be... And sometimes when you'll come into a village, people want to know about your equipment, what you're up to. Were you a source of curiosity for village people?
I think in a way, yes. I think it was very interesting for folks to ask us how we got between one place and another. So I think we were talking about things that happened to them and their families in the past. And so for them to be able to relate that to the way we were traveling was very interesting. So for them to say, well, my grandfather or my uncle or I have traveled between this place overland as well, that was a nice way to build a relationship around that.
Yeah, and you know, what we were talking about was inherently spatial, like as Kate uh-huh. was talking about. So we could... during the interviews, people could say, oh, well, you're going to be going by this place in a day and a half on skis, so just check it out. You know, this is what I know about that area. And we can walk by there. We could stop for 3 hours and look at it. We could, look at it as we go by. But as Kate said, you know, we're going by one step at a time. And always with these stories swirling through your head of people's experience with this very specific area. So there was... It was very, I'd say it was very special for us having done things differently in the past, you know, flying in and sitting in a boardroom and interviewing and then flying out. And this was just really enjoyable because you could really engage with the landscape and based on what people were saying instead of, looking at a USGS quad and trying to picture what they're talking mm-hmm. about.
Go ahead.
Oh, and, it was also very interesting for us to be able to, you mentioned curiosity about gear and planning and those things. And in several places, we were invited to speak to students and lay out our gear. And we did that on occasion with a few different schools and a few different villages and have kids test out the pack rafts and mm-hmm. in the gym, of course. But, I think that was an interesting way for them to get to know us as well. So we were able to...
And people would say, that's how we used to get around. Used to walk or we used to go by dog team.
But
and
not anymore,
not anymore. So we were a bit of a novelty in that sense, I'd say. I think we looked at it as being respectful. You know, we respect the people and the knowledge they possess. And this was, at least from our standpoint, I feel like a small way to signify mm-hmm. our respect, like we were taking the time to walk.
Well, and you were working, which I think sometimes there's a disconnect between outdoor people who are sort of urban and view the outdoors, sort of wilderness, as a playground, and rural people who views it as like their home or the place that they work. And you were kind of bridging that a little bit. I mean, are you aware sort of those different perspectives that people have?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because I feel like I've been a part of both. We both lived in Anchorage for a long time, and we're very active in the Chugach, and we've traveled the Brooks Range and other areas and done trips, and now we live in a more rural area, and I've done a lot of work in rural Alaska, so there are differences there. I mean, the people who, there's people that fly from all over the world to walk in these valleys and mm-hmm. float these rivers in Alaska. And, it's a little bit different when you live there and you see those people coming and going. I think there's some curiosity there for
yeah.
sure.
I would think that having a sense of purpose on a trip like this would really enhance it. You're not just there for yourself. You're there for a bigger reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We've, like I said, we've done those trips where the point is the trip and to be out there. And, you know, this was,
and you start suffering and you wonder why, but
yeah. And you know, this, you know, you have that goal and purpose there. And, you know, it also changes the gear you bring. I've never done a month long backcountry trip in Alaska where I brought iPads and cameras and batteries and recharging stuff. And it's where I'm usually, cutting weight wherever I can. So it was interesting in that sense.
Yeah. Sure. Anything you'd do differently if you were planning for a future trip?
No, I mean, maybe longer.
Yeah.
I think we both really enjoyed the trip, and I think it was getting to know people in each community. It felt like the amount of time that we spent there, the 3 or 4 or 5 days in each place, wasn't nearly long enough.
Did you make any friends you're still in touch with?
Yes, as a matter of fact, yes.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I'd say if I did anything differently, it would be to instill the sense that there doesn't need to be people coming from afar to collect this kind of information. And, you know, I think a lot of times research efforts have budgets and time limits, and are like, oh, we can't afford to go there. There can be some training involved where youth or other people can sit down with elders and, you know, they create connections in the community, which most communities like to create those youth and elder connections. And
it'd be nice if it stopped being special, right? It's if the information flow became a little bit easier.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I'd say a lot of rural communities would agree with that. Yeah. And there's a lot of effort in place, I think, in a lot of these places to make it just more normal, you know, instead of, a special day at the in the classroom or something. You know?
Right. And it'd be good for more urban people to get more in touch with the rest of Alaska, too, to really have that sense of who we really are as a state. Yeah. Oh, wait. Oh, this has been really interesting. Congratulations on a great trip. I'll be really interested to hear what else you guys are up to. Caleb Billmeyer, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Kate Homan Billmeyer.
Thank you.
You can learn more about their work on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show about cultural journeys. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Stay with us. As Iditarod mushers were finishing their 1,000-mile journey earlier this year, a family of four was just beginning their own trek under the ceremonial Burled Arch. Brettwood Hig Higman, Aaron McKittrick, and their two young kids, Katmai and Latuya, trekked 500 miles from Nome to Kotzebue by walking, skiing, and paddling. Hig and Aaron have been on the show before. Their group is called Ground Truth Trekking. This report comes to us at the start of their trip from Karen Leffler in Nome.
Brettwood, or Hig Higman, Aaron McKittrick, and their two young kids, Katmai and Latuya, started their 500-mile trek from Nome to Kotzebue. They plan to walk, ski, and paddle up the Bering Strait.
Planning to head out around the coast and visit all the villages along the way and then end up in Kotzebue.
We have, for instance, pack rafts that right now we're putting skids on and going to be using as sleds, but we expect we'll actually be paddling in them at some point, or at least have that possibility. We've got the kids have skis, and we can put these little things on top of them to make them into kick sleds, and they can also ride in the raft sled, or they can walk. So we've got all these different possibilities that hopefully some combination of those will make for a fun, successful trip.
Aaron and Hig met in college in Minnesota and soon got hooked on long-distance trekking. In 2007, they trekked 4,000 miles from Seattle to the Aleutian Islands, spending over a year in the wilderness. After having kids, they thought they'd have to put those long treks aside for a while. But instead, their 6-year-old and 4-year-old come along for the journeys.
We did a few little trips, though, with the kids, and actually even when Aaron was pregnant with Katmai and such, and started saying, you know, this is really quite possible, and thinking about the fact that historically, like, people traveled and did all kinds of incredible things with kids.
And it's a learning experience for all of them. Hig and Aaron have backgrounds in geology and molecular biology, respectively, and their expeditions allow them to see climate change right before their eyes.
Going around Alaska right now and looking at the effects of climate change, you can go out and be in places where you're seeing changes that are happening on human timescales, that over just a few years, landscapes changing, rivers moving, new plants coming in, glaciers retreating. All of this stuff is happening really, really fast.
Through blogs, books, and films, they hope to share their observations to help educate people about the effects of climate change. This time, they're really interested in learning about sea ice changes, and they are always looking to learn from the people they meet along the way. Reporting in Nome, I'm Kristen Loeffler.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. Find Outdoor Explorer anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. We're also available online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer, Charles Woolforth, and we're talking about cultural journeys, connections made between scientists, explorers, and Alaska Native people and the different perspectives they have on things. And in the first half of the show, we were talking with Caleb Billmeyer and Caden talking about their exploration around Lake Iliamna, where they were meeting Native people and learning about the geology of that region. And in this part of the show, we're going to be talking from the other perspective, from an Alaska Native elder who has worked with scientists and has offered his observations as a subsistence hunter out in the Northwest Arctic. So I have with me today Merlin Kunuka, who is an elder in Gamble, which is on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. Merlin is a member of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. He's a board member of Kuwarik, which is the nonprofit for the Northwest Arctic region, and he's been involved in somewhat in the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and lives in Gamble and joins us from Gamble by telephone. Thanks for being with us, Merlin.
Thank you, too. Happy to be here.
So this is an opportunity for our listeners to learn about what you do, but also learn about where you live, what Gamble is like and what St. Lawrence Island is like. Not many people from Anchorage have ever been there. Tell us about a little bit about the village and what your lifestyle is like there.
Gamble, geographically, it's our closest neighbor is Russia. The village of Umazik, now they call it New Chaplino, but we speak common dialect, Eskimo dialect, Yupik dialect. Sometimes it's called Siberian Yupik, or sometimes it's called St. Lawrence Yupik. And the other closest neighbor we have is Savoga, Alaska, the other village on the island of St. Lawrence. And we own the whole island, surface and subsurface, under the Land Claim Settlement Act. And we are true subsistence house hunters out here. We hunt the marine mammals that surround us in the ocean. And only land animal that we have for subsistence is the reindeer, which was introduced here in the 1800s or so. And other than that, we hunt from the ocean.
Yeah.
Whales, walrus, different species of seals and birds and fish and you name it, we had it.
Do you, is your hunting, your walrus hunting and whale hunting, is it depend on ice at all? Or what is the style of hunting you do for the walrus and whale and seal?
On the walrus, it's an ice animal. But, and the main harvest that takes place out here is in the spring, in the month of, mainly in May, month of May. And for the past 3 years, we haven't had a normal walrus hunt in the springtime, mostly due to the sea ice that disappearing. We were losing it way ahead of time. And this is the time when walrus, haul out on the ice and bear their young, the female and the young is our main source of walrus hunting in the springtime. So for 3 years, like I mentioned, this is not happening normally as it did. And we observe that this is becoming more and more common and more intensive on the loss of sea ice and the walrus that migrate before we are able to conduct our hunt.
How does that affect the village and the people in the village in terms of their food supply if they're not able to hunt for the walrus?
Can you repeat that, please?
I say when you lose the spring walrus hunt, as you just mentioned, how does that affect the village and the people in the village in terms of their food supply, the food that they have to eat?
Yeah. Last time I counted, we had like over 40 walrus hunting crews from the village. And when you see, including myself, haven't been able to harvest any spring walrus like I've always done all my life. I'm 77 years old this month, and all my life I've been a walrus hunter. And you look around in the springtime where we hang our walrus or put in the freezers or other ways of storage, we find that nowadays non-evident. Empty racks all over the village. And it makes you wonder, we used to fill them up every year and now they're gone. How is this going to affect us? I always ask myself that question too. And what we depend on right now, as far as manguna. We call walrus hide and meat with the blubber. We call it manguna. It's the main part of the walrus that we hunt. In the winter time, we are able to hunt, but these are mostly male walrus that we hunt in the winter. We're able to harvest in the winter time, and he doesn't fully meet our need for the whole year. So thanks to the winter hunt, we are able to have a little manguna to help us.
Uh-huh.
And when the ice is gone, you know, we have nothing but open water out there, and the area where we live, it's better known as a windy area, and with the absence of ice, it's hard to get out there and conduct any kind of a hunt by boat. And last year we were fortunate to land one whale, a bowhead whale, before the ice went away.
So a lot less than you used to get, a lot less walrus, a lot less whale than you used to be able to harvest.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And the state declared that the subsistence disaster for us last year, a year before. And with that, we were able to get some food from outside, like halibut mostly, some salmon. But this stuff doesn't go very far in providing us the food that we are used to eating and subsisting on. You can't get any seal oil from halibut or salmon or other animals like that.
Yeah. And I don't know, some of our listeners might not know that in Eskimo tables, there's often like a pot of seal oil in the middle and you dip food in it, and it's quite delicious and adds a lot of nutrition to whatever you're eating. So the changes that are taking place, is there some interest from scientists coming out to the island to learn about what's happening, anthropologists and oceanographers and biologists studying these changes, have you done any work with scientists who are trying to understand what's happening?
As far as I know, outside people, like you mentioned, are aware of what's happening, but so far haven't been able to get some concrete plan of help in some way, although we are trying in many ways to get outside help.
Do you gather observations about what's happening, or do you do any of that kind of work to look at what's happening and kind of gather information?
Yes. As far as I know, everyone, the whole world, knows of the loss of sea ice and warming waters and so forth.
Right, right. So
everyone observes the weather, gets weather reports, and on a broader area too, from Anchorage area, and scientists and meteorologists and so forth.
Yeah. Do you use any of those? I mean, you probably use the weather reports and the satellite images when you're planning your hunting trips, right?
Yeah, the modern weather reports that we are able to get nowadays, that helps to know what's going to happen every year. And from what I hear, this winter, it's going to be even warmer. And the sea is going to melt. The sea ice is going to melt again much earlier. And this will be our fourth year of this thing happening and affecting us in ways we used to depend on.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing, and I'm really hoping that doesn't turn out to be true. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we are talking about cultural journeys, connections between the dominant culture and Alaska Native cultures. My guest is Merlin Kunica, who is in Gamble on St. Lawrence Island. He's a member of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and Kuwarak. He's a board member and elder representative. That's the nonprofit for that Northwest Arctic area, native nonprofit. And Merlin is an elder in the community and obviously has a lot of knowledge about what has happened there, is happening now in terms of change, and also the traditional knowledge of that area. I'm interested, Merlin, in do many visitors come out to Gamble? I mean, do you don't get a lot of tourists out there. Do you get anthropologists or other visitors, or does anybody at all come out to St. Lawrence Island who doesn't live there?
Yes, a lot of people like to see what life is like this part of the world, you know, in Gamble. We get a lot of bird watchers from different groups, but these include people from Anchorage. I've found out past a few years. And we've had archaeologists and anthropologists visiting us since far as I can remember. They've been here, and we've been studied a lot, our ways of life from all those years, thousands of years. Some people know more about us than we do ourselves, so we've studied a lot, I have to tell you. We're the ones that know about ourselves the best anyway. We observe what's going on. We started observing effects of warming, climate change, when it first started, and we saw the beginnings of it, but so far, we've been able to adapt and survive, and what's happening in the past 3 years now, we're beginning to see the seriousness of climate warming and sea ice disappearance.
Yeah. So how do you, it sounds like a lot of anthropologists and a lot of other scientists have come to talk to you and interview you and gather information and go off and write their scientific papers. How do you guys feel about that? Do you feel like they are respectful and that has value? Do you get tired of being interviewed, or do you feel okay about it?
Yeah, I should first mention that we are a friendly people, and our ancestors, when they first come in contact with outside people, the Yankee whalers and other people, they met them with open arms, and they like to mention that we are friendly people out here, and then soon after the first contact, you know, we begin to see the bad side of contact with the modern world, including disease and alcohol and bad stuff like that. It's something everybody knows about, I guess. And due to that first contact, we almost lost the island population as a result, due to starvation and disease and things like that. But we are now at a point in time where we are in good terms with outsiders. We work together, they give us help, and some don't present the correct picture or information of what we are really like. So we know what to expect, and we know how to deal with people now, and general terms, we are in good friends with outsiders.
Yeah, and I have always found that Gambel and Savunga are very, very friendly villages, and I've always wanted to go there because it seems like your hospitality is very warm. Every time I've done research about your villages, people have been very kind. There was a anthropologist named Igor Krupnik from Smithsonian who was out there maybe 15 years ago, and he did a book called The Earth is Faster Now. And it was a book using observations of elders from St. Lawrence Island. I don't know if you remember him, but one of the things about that book was it was one of the very first things that talked about how Native people in the North were noticing the climate changing, and well before a lot of scientists were noticing it, and the elders of the communities in St. Lawrence were noticing these changes because they had so much experience in the environment of the Arctic and of your island, and so they saw patterns that scientists might not have noticed yet, even with their satellites and weather forecasts. And one of the observations in that book, The Earth is Faster Now, is talking about different weather patterns, or how the weather patterns had changed. And when the scientists who studied that went back and looked at their data, looked at their satellite images, they verified, they said, wow, this is something we never noticed, but these patterns have changed. They're coming through faster now. And I think it's interesting that Native people, because of their knowledge and time spent, and probably knowledge passed down through generations, at times have a better feel, better understanding of environmental patterns than people even who have a lot of equipment and scientific knowledge.
Yeah, I'm proud of the fact that we've been able to survive thousands of years. You find the harshest weather and climate in our region here, especially in the middle of the Bering Strait where we are, where all the bad weather passes through. But we have survived, and not only survived, but found ways to become more effective in our subsistence hunting, so one to mention one. And we live right in the middle of biodiversity, and we have ice, we got good ice, and we get out there in the ocean and we observe what is going on. We observe any changes that are taking place just by going up the mountain or down the beach and notice what we are noticing. So people are very adaptive to any changes that are taking place, and hopefully we can handle and deal with climate change in the near future in some way. And also observing the marine mammals out there, we know they are able to adapt themselves also in their own feeding habits and breeding and all that stuff. In the absence of ice, we are able to see that they are hauling out on land, the beaches up north, where there used to be ice. But when it all melts away, they haul out on both sides of the continent, the western side and the Alaskan side. And when the ice forms, they are able to float out this way in the months of December later, as we can all notice. They show up again in their numbers, and we are able to see that they are surviving, and we are happy about this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is all about adaptation and finding new ways of living, for sure. Merlin, I want to thank you very, very much for talking to us today. Merlin Kunica from Gamble on St. Lawrence Island. Thanks so much for sharing your knowledge and your insights with us. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you for calling. It's my pleasure.
That's all for our show today. Thanks to Caleb Billmeyer and Kate Holman of Ground Truth Tracking, who we heard from in the first half of the show. And in the second half, Milton Kunica, the elder from the community of Gamble on St. Lawrence Island. Tune in next week. We're talking about the money and upkeep needed in our state parks. As we go into a period of austerity, our parks already have huge maintenance backlogs. My guests are former State Parks Director Jim Stratton and the current director, Ben Ellis. It'll be a lively discussion. Our producer on Outdoor Explorer is Monica Gokey. Grace Bogine is our production assistant, helps line up the guests. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.